Chapter 14, Mentors and Role Models, A Profound Fingerprint. Silicon Valley CEO John Kispert described the impact a mentor can have on our lives as a profound fingerprint. Our lives can be shaped by people we meet early on. In Chapter 13, we learned about the importance of risk-taking for our success in life. Risk-taking is a gutsy thing to do and can involve uncertainty and real danger to our future, our incomes, our relationships, and even sometimes our lives. This is where the mentor comes in. Someone walking beside us and giving us that dream-saving advice at just the right time can make all the difference in how our lives turn out. This is big stuff, absolutely critical. A role model may be someone we don't even know personally, but admire from afar, maybe a professor or maybe a business leader. A mentor, on the other hand, is someone who takes a personal interest in us and coaches us. This influence may be short-lived or it can go on for years. This relationship is almost never with our parents. It usually happens after we leave home. This is why professors or bosses in our first jobs can do so much to shape our thinking and the future outcomes of our lives. In this chapter, we'll meet business people, CEOs, and even a musician whose successes in life were shaped by their relationships with mentors and/or the influences of other role models. Steve Blank explains why a mentor relationship is a two-way street, and then he shares a vivid example of what he learned from a leader in technology sales.
If you're lucky, in your 20s and 30s, you will find somebody who will take an interest in your career and will change your life. The unspoken part of mentorship is that it's a two-way street. That is, what I didn't realize about my career is, while these people mentored me, the reason why they were mentoring me and not the other 200 people in the company was they saw something in me that made them smarter as well. So now when I mentor people, I'm semi-consciously picking not only people who I think are smart, but when the two of us get together, they make my head spin around as well. That is, the fact that they're 10 or 20 years younger than me or more means that they're connected in a way to either technology or culture or something I don't know. And what I've given in return is time and grade, my experience. And it's the combination of that relationship over time is what makes a mentorship. You need to understand whether you need a teacher, coach, or mentor. If you have nothing to give back, then don't chase somebody to be a mentor. You ought to be taking some classes or hiring coaches. If you think you are in a place where you have something to offer, that's different. Then you're now ready for a mentorship. Remember, not everybody has a career where they get mentored. Some of it is just lack of access to people who can mentor, but some of it is about you. And you really need to understand that. I think I was not mentorable for the first 5 or 6 years of my career. And then I think when I had enough knowledge and started actually thinking about things rather than just doing, I was able to give back in these conversations.
Can you think of a story, a particular intervention that the mentor did?
Very different way of teaching, very different way of mentorship. This guy either liked me or needed me or both, but I was the VP of marketing. And I truly understood our product backwards and forwards. I could talk architecture, I could talk technology and whatever. And our sales guy was no slouch. He was also an engineer by training and hit it well. And so the first time or two I go out on a field sales call with him, he said, Steve, do you want to run the first meeting? I said, sure. He had never seen me. And at the time, we were selling computers to other computer companies. And the meetings were usually with their engineering executives and staff who were already defensive that their management was forcing them to buy computers from another computer company. And so there was just a lot of ego involved in the room, none of which I was sensitive to. And being young, not only completely clueless, enormously arrogant that, well, of course, we won. Our system was better. So I'm going to stand up here and tell you essentially why you're an idiot. And therefore, the only logical conclusion at the end of this meeting was you'll see how smart we were, and you'll have to buy our computer. You can imagine how that meeting went. And the VP of sales, I always remember that meeting, his head kept going lower and lower into his hands, and I couldn't understand why. And only decades later did I understand how wonderful this guy was. Because after the first meeting, he said, perhaps you might want to watch me in the next meeting. Okay, I thought I did great. I just didn't understand why they didn't all jump up and down and like try to give us a purchase order. I mean, just we nicely got escorted out of that company. So the next morning we meet for breakfast, and I watched this guy, as we're eating breakfast, start jotting notes about the sports scores in the local newspaper. What the heck is this? Does he have a bookie? I didn't understand this. So we go into the next meeting in a different company, and I'm ready to present, and Rob kicks me under the table and says, no, let me go. And so Rob says, hey, how's the family? And he happened to remember meeting some of these guys before, and he starts talking about their wives and their kids. I'm going, wives, kids, let's talk about our technology. And this goes on for about 5 or 10 minutes, and Rob is talking about kids and family and what. And then, okay, we must be ready. And so I'm about to, and Rob kicks me again. And he says, how about them insert name of team here? And he knew all the local sports scores. And I'm going, how did he know? And I remember he was writing down all the sports scores. And all of a sudden, the discussion is going on for another 10 minutes about the local teams. And I'm thinking, we're wasting valuable technical time. Finally, I thought it's now my time. And Rob starts by saying, listen, I'm almost embarrassed we're here. You guys are the smartest engineers, you know, the industry has ever seen. And I'm thinking, smartest engineers? We're about to put you out of business. What is he talking about? And they're agreeing, yeah, we're the best. And he says, you know, if you had the money we raised, if your bosses would have been smart enough to give it to you, you could have built better computers than we ever. And they're agreeing, why, of course. This goes on for another time, and I'm just going, what's he talking about? Why don't we tell them what geniuses we are? And finally they say, well, listen, Rob, you know, now that you understand all that, yeah, we're ready to go hear what you want to say. And Rob now kicks me under the table and says, okay, why don't you just tell them what we have? Now, what I just had been taught was the master of the consultative sale. And it was by just watching a master at work, where my approach would have been to go in like a bull in a china shop, not understanding the entire context and emotional needs of the situation. I had just been taught and would learn from this guy for the next 3 or 4 years on how to sell in a way that I never would have learned. And he was patient enough not to strangle me and throw me out the car and leave me at the side of the road.
CEO and venture capitalist Dan Eilers describes a life-shaping relationship with his family physician.
Did you have anybody other than your parents, you know, like an aunt or an uncle or somebody that had sort of an influence in that direction?
We did actually have, as it turned out, a family physician who was a bit of a mentor to me, of all things. He was a family physician, and he was a professor at the University of Oregon Health Sciences Center, the medical school. And he saw in me some promise, I guess, and he saw in me a drive to move beyond my parents' socioeconomic status. And he saw in me some desire to be helpful to people. And he really coached me when it came time for going to college, for instance. He suggested that I consider various colleges that were higher end colleges and so forth. So he was a very influential person to me, starting from about the time I was in eighth grade.
So you had a long-term connection with him then?
I had a long-term connection with him and maintained it until his death.
A great example of a role model is a momentary interaction that Ned Barnhold had with Bill Hewlett, the co-founder and then CEO of Hewlett-Packard. Ned was just out of school and a new hire at HP when he met Bill Hewlett.
I was a new engineer in the lab. I think I'd been there maybe 6 months. And there was several of us who got together and decided we would design the world's best stereo system. And so I was designing an amplifier and somebody else was doing a power supply and somebody else was doing the mechanical design. So we had six of us that were designing this world-class stereo. And one day the lab manager, and we were doing this all in the evenings or weekends because we were all single. One day the lab manager came over to my desk and said, would I fix Bill Hewlett's hi-fi or a stereo system? So I said, sure. Next thing I knew, Bill Hewlett was standing right behind me. He had this KLH stereo system there, brought it over and was chatting with me. And, you know, I started taking it apart and then he got called away. This was about 11 in the morning. And he said, well, I'll come back at 2 and pick it up. By the way, when Bill Hewlett came, the lab manager came, and John Young, who was the division manager at the time, came. So I had basically my entire chain of command around my desk. And so they said they'd be back at 2 o'clock. Bill would be back to pick it up. So it was a tough problem. I was really sweating bullets trying to figure this thing out. Finally, about 1 or 1:30, I figured out what was going on, and I fixed it, and I was, you know, buttoning it up when Bill came back at 2 o'clock, and John Young came and Paul Ely came. They were all kind of standing around my desk. And Bill got kind of said, would you mind if I tuned up my own amplifier? So he got in there and tuned his amplifiers and did everything himself. But then he stopped and said, he just chatted. He said, why did you join the company? How do you like it here? What have you found that you attracted you to join? And so he must have spent 20 minutes talking to me as this, you know, young engineer, I mean, right out of school. And that always impressed me that here's somebody that was the CEO of the company, cared about individuals at the entry level like that. And that always stuck with me. Even when I became CEO, I remembered that story about what a big difference it makes if I could take time when I went around the labs or different places to, you know, shake hands, talk to people, get to know them a little personally. Why did you join? How's it going? You know, that was a key part of my management style and philosophy.
That one interaction with Bill Hewlett helped to shape the rest of Ned Barnholt's career, especially when he became a CEO himself. Former Spansion CEO John Kispert recalls what he learned working in a New York deli from the owner, Bill Helmer. John was just 12 years old when he worked in the deli, and the workday started at 5 a.m. John learned about being customer-focused and reducing cycle time running the deli. These skills still inform his work today with customers worldwide. Bill Helmer was both a role model and a mentor to John.
Part of growing up in New York was at a very early age, maybe 12 years old, I started working at a local delicatessen. I was certainly learning a lot about different aspects of running a business by the time I was in high school. The guy I worked for, the owner, taught me a ton. He was very hard on me. You know, he ran a very, very good organization, shop. Bill Helmer died in a car accident at a young age. He would pick me up at my house at 5 a.m. That's when you open a store and for the early workers. I learned that work starts at 5 a.m. at, you know, age 14. you know, little things like that, they go a long way over life. Preparation is what counts.
So he mattered a lot to you.
Yes, I didn't realize it at the time. I was probably too young. You know, years later, you look back, as I'm sure other people do, and everybody does, and thinks about who are the people that kind of had a profound fingerprint on you, and he did. His view was, and I carry this with me today, there's not a moment that you're working that you shouldn't be doing something. You know, there's always something to be done, and that was his credo and how he operated. Very, very quick-twitched muscles. He was constantly on the move, and he's right. You know, if you're particularly in a service kind of a business like that, you're forever trying to take care of people and keep the cycle time of the store moving very quickly. And then he would impress upon that me over and over and over again, and that carries through in any business. You know, there's always a window to be cleaned, or a roast beef to be trimmed, or a potato salad to be made, or you know, a paper to be stacked, or a new fresh coffee to be made, or a supplier to be paid, or and it's a 24/7 business, and just stay on top of it, make it part of the muscle memory. He really drove into me, put your head down, enjoy this, and learn every day, and just keep working hard. And good things happen, but don't ever rest on that. Do not be complacent. Oh, it's very predictable, 365 days a year. You could get the hottest coffee, the coldest beer, the best catering, the best service.
How has that informed the way that you run your company?
That predictability. And that's kind of in my ethos. It has been since I was 12 years old. In my business today, I've got customers everywhere in the world. And every culture is the same. You know, people will pay for that level of service, that level of high-end product, but that predictability. Nobody wants surprises in a business transaction.
Grammy-nominated jazz pianist Taylor Eichsti recalls the influence the Brubeck family had on him early in his career.
And actually, Dave Brubeck was one of them, kind of like a little bit of a grandpa figure and stuff. And I, you know, was always cool being around him, learned a lot from him. And the whole Brubeck family, Chris and Dan Brubeck, I started traveling a lot with them when I was 14. I joined their band, the Brubeck Brothers. And, you know, they were just like uncles.
Congresswoman Anna Eshoo's relationship with then California Lieutenant Governor Leo McCarthy is a perfect example of both a role model and a mentor in the same person.
Yeah. Did you have somebody who you kind of would call a mentor during those early years? Somebody
I did later on, Leo McCarthy.
Tell me a little about that.
Well, I met Leo McCarthy when Leo Ryan was killed.
Okay.
At that time, I was the new chair of the Democratic Party in San Mateo County. And when I look back, really quite green, you know, didn't think so then, but I obviously was. I was the first woman that was ever elected chair of the party in San Mateo County. That fall, the tragedy befell so many when Congressman Ryan, the first member of Congress in the history of the Congress to be killed in the line of duty. Mm. And at that time, part of San Mateo County, the part of northern San Mateo County, was in Leo McCarthy's assembly district. And of course, he was the speaker of the state legislature, and that we came to know one another and became very, very, very dear friends. So he was a great, great mentor and example to me. And some years later, he asked me to be his chief of staff of his district office, which I did do.
Can you give an example of the mentorship, some specific incident that came up?
He took me under his wing. I didn't see in myself what he saw in me.
Say a little more about that.
Yeah. Well, I remember he came to something when I was running for Congress, and he heard me speak. It was at someone's home. It was at a professor's home at Stanford. And I talked to him afterward. I called him as soon as I got home. And I said, Leo, I didn't get a chance to chat with you. And he said, no, you couldn't. You had to, you know, talk to each person there. I understand. I said, how did I do? How did I do? And he said, who's the teacher? Who's the student? And I was so moved by that. I mean, my heart was soaring that because I'd so, you can tell how the effect it has on me, that he who I thought so much of had placed his imprimatur on me, that I measured up, you know, for him. And so that meant, you know, a great deal.
It touches
and
you.
It touches me very deeply. Well, relationships mean everything mm-hmm. to me, Rick.
Former CEO and member of Walgreens Board of Directors, Ginger Graham, was mentored early in her career by leaders in the various industries she worked in. Another example of a person who was both a mentor and a role model was her relationship with her district sales manager, Charles Moody. Moody risked a large piece of business in order to support his new sales associate, who by her own description was a green bean.
Well, you know, when you first take a job out of school, you are, in every sense, a green bean. And I was one of those, taking a job with a large company in agriculture called Elanco. It was the leading agriculture chemical company in the world at the time. But I had no exposure to row crops, soybeans or cotton, rice. And so I was inexperienced in every sense. And I was also the first woman that was hired in that area. And so I was young, I was a female, the first one in the company in that area, and I didn't know the business. And so you can imagine a district manager's reticence to take me as an employee. But he embraced my development and spent a lot of time with me, helped me understand how to compete, how to learn, how to grow up. I was 21 years old, and he was there when I didn't know I needed someone, but did. Great advice and counsel. And there's one really good story in my experience. He was in charge of a large district, and it was all guys who have been there for many years, were very successful. We were selling the number one herbicide in the country, and I had one very large customer that was key to my new territory. The territory had been chopped from a big territory into a half, so a long-term sales rep was pulled away from this customer, and the customer didn't want to deal with me. He didn't want to deal with a woman. He didn't want to deal with a novice, and he was asking for his old rep back, and he called my boss. And that one customer made my territory. So you can imagine if my boss had caved in because it was good for business and let that customer get his old rep back, I would have not been able to prove that I could be successful as a sales rep. And when he took that call and the customer wanted his rep back, my district manager said, "Gee, that's a shame. You won't be doing business with us. But when you are ready, please call Ginger." And of course, I had the chance then to be persistent, to go back again and again, to get that business, to earn that business, and over time, earn a friendship with that customer and be successful as a sales rep.
He was willing to lose the business.
He was willing to forego the business to make a point that he was going to stand by his employees and do what was right. And I admire him for that to this day. We still keep in touch. It does. He's very important to me. His name is Charles Moody.
Ginger goes on to define mentoring as an interaction that doesn't need to be formal necessarily.
And also mentoring, whether it's women or men, is a gift that you're giving of time and energy and caring. But to be able to listen to concerns and match them to another person who has the same issue, or to tell them, yes, that happened to me too, and it's going to be okay. Those are simple acts of mentoring that can be so useful, because many times we take things personally. We think we failed, or it's about us, or they're after me, when in fact, it's just the reality of human interactions. And so to give the person a gift, which is simply to say, I made that mistake too, and here's a couple of things I tried later, you might want to think about them. That is great mentoring. And I was the beneficiary of mentoring many times in my career, just like that. Not something official and constrained, but hey, here's an idea. Think about this.
For me, mentors have made all the difference. Over a lifetime, three stand out. My first therapist and two professors from San Francisco State.
The first, of course, was my first therapist named Ib Harris. I was 16 years old. I was terrified. My life was a shambles. I wasn't doing anything right. I wasn't getting any grades. It was just a mess. And I thought, I've got to get some help. So I decided to go see a therapist. I was terrified. My guts were trembling. I knocked on her door. I knew that she was going to be able to see that I was a phony, a fake, not doing very well, and I didn't have much of a future. "Hi, Rick. Come on in. Good to meet you." Well, so far, so good. We went into the consulting room, and I sat in the patient's chair, and she sat across from me. And then she said a sentence that changed my life from that day to this. Very simple sentence. She said, "Rick, tell me about yourself." Wow. Nobody had said that to me. Or if they did, they sure as hell didn't listen. She listened. And I stayed with her for a number of years. I was friends with her occasionally, would see her. For 15 years until she finally died. But she changed my life. And in fact, when it was time to go to college, of course, I wanted to go into psychology because I had been in therapy. Now, I have to explain to you about therapy. One of the things about therapy is I really liked it because I learned very quickly in therapy that there are two components to why I am the way I am, getting in trouble with the cops. I mean, there are only two components. One is genetic and one is environmental. Either way, it's not my fault. So who wouldn't like therapy? You know, it's your parents, those teachers didn't appreciate, blah, blah, you know. So I go into psychology. I finally ended up being a therapist myself. I went on to college, San Francisco State, and I met this wonderful man. His name is Bob Dreher. I was 21, 22 years old. Had a couple of classes from him. Got to know him personally. Went to his house, met his wife, looked at his art collection. He was very big in the psychology of art. And I fell in love with this man the minute he walked in the door. Tweed jacket, leather elbows, interested in the world of ideas, trying to understand what makes people work. I said, I want to be like that. I want to be that guy. I don't want to be my father and sell insurance. I want to be this guy. That's how, I mean, I was just totally, totally pulled into this guy. He wrote me letters of recommendation. My relationship with him went on for years. And the most exciting piece of it was when I was then in graduate school myself, working on my doctorate, I had written an article that got published in a psychological journal. This is the American Academy of Psychotherapists. Well, I couldn't have been more proud of that. So I put a copy of it in Bob Dreher's mailbox. I was teaching at San Francisco State. I put a copy in his mailbox, and several days later, I got a letter back from him. And he was, you know, going over what he thought about the article and blah, blah, blah. And then the final paragraph of that letter to me said, "I find your article a beautifully literate piece. It is vital and humane like its author. So it goes without saying, both in person and in print, I love you very much, little brother." I mean, I had to go in the corner. I collapsed for a while. I mean, I was just blown away because nobody said stuff like that to me. And that love that he had for me and that I had for him, it made me think that maybe I can do this after all. You know, maybe I can be successful in school and stuff. But that's not all. Then there was Bob Suchet, another faculty member at State, and he worked with me on my PhD dissertation, 3 years of writing, big 400-piece behemoth. And we would argue sometimes, and he wanted me to make changes, and I didn't want to make changes, and every time I made the damn changes, they made it better. So we had a good relationship, and at the end of the whole process, I sent him a bound copy of this thing, and he wrote back, nice letter, you know, critiquing it all, and then his final sentence said, "What you may not have known, Rick, is that I needed you as much as you needed me." I wouldn't have known that. And he was very sort of quiet. He didn't share a lot of his feelings. And one of the things I learned about that is that if we're in a mentor relationship, it's going to be reciprocal. It's not just one way. The mentors want to get something back from us. Or if we're the mentor, the person, they better give me something. They better light my fire, because otherwise, why am I doing it?
In summary, role models and mentors can help shape our lives. If you're young and just starting out, please embrace this idea. Become aware of these people in your life. It may be a formal or an informal relationship. As you get older, stay in touch with these people. It will continue to enrich you, and it will mean the world to them. A deep sadness I carry with me into my later years is that I lost touch with Ib Harris, Bob Dreher, and Bob Suchet. I was too busy moving on with my own life. In their retirement years, occasional letters from me, maybe even meeting for lunch once in a while, could have been a thrill for both of us. A few years ago, I met with Bob Suchet's son, William. What he told me about his dad broke my heart. Bob Suchet loved jazz and used to play Dave Brubeck and Miles Davis on the weekends with the family as he cooked breakfast for everyone. No wonder Bob was interested in helping me with my dissertation about popular music and psychotherapy. Years later, when I started Power Speaking, Bob would receive our monthly newsletters and proudly show them to William, saying, "This is one of my former students." I had no idea. I wish I'd made it a priority to stay connected. So please, stay in touch with your mentors. And oh, by the way, be open to mentoring others as you get some experience under your belt. You may just change some lives. The final chapter in Phase 2, Adulthood, is communication. Learning the skills of communication early in our adult years can make life go much smoother.